I'm Andy Bates, part of the team here at KFUO. While you hear me on the air and in podcasts, I'm also part of the team that works behind the scenes to bring you the programs like this that you value. What you hear on the air and in podcasts is just the tip of the iceberg. Listeners like you generously support everything that makes radio and podcasts happen. Administration, cutting-edge technology, software, hosts, producers, and more. You make this happen. Can we count on you to continue this support? KFUO Share-a-thon, now through April 5th, is a great time to show your support and make a gift or make a plan to give for a whole year. Your generosity is important and appreciated, not just by the KFUO team, but by listeners who get to hear and enjoy Christ-centered programs every day. Will you make a gift today? KFUO.org/give. KFUO.org/give.
Good morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Thursday, March 27th, we're studying 2 Samuel chapter 3, verses 1 to 30. In today's text, one of the key figures in the house of Saul switches sides to support David. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, Pastor Jeff Hemmer. Pastor Hemmer serves at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. He is also the assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Pastor Hemmer, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Great to be with you, Pastor Apple.
As we get started today, Pastor Hemmer, remind us of the context as we are getting ready to start chapter 3 of 2 Samuel.
Yeah, so since the end of 1 Samuel, Saul and his sons are killed in battle, defeated by the Philistines. The question of who will rule the kingdom now that the king is dead has sort of been what's held our attention for the first couple chapters in 2 Samuel. The Lord anointed David to be the king to succeed Saul after Saul falls out of favor with the Lord, all the way back in the middle of 1 Samuel. So he is the one whom the Lord has chosen to be the king over his people. And after Saul dies in chapter 2, the men of Judah, so in the south, what would later become the southern kingdom, but just for now, the tribe in the south, anoint David to be their king. So they install him as king, the one whom the Lord anointed from the beginning. So they're doing what is pleasing in the sight of the Lord. But Abner, who's the commander of Saul's army, sets up Ishbosheth, one of the sons of Saul, not one of the sons who's killed in the battle, so not a warrior son, it seems, sets up Ishbosheth as the king over the tribes in the north, over the Asherites, Jezreel, Ephraim, Benjamin, and all Israel. So he's reigning in the north. David's reigning in the south. You have the house of Saul, represented by Saul's son Ishbosheth, versus the house of David, the Lord's anointed to be the successor to King Saul, at odds with one another and fighting one another. So we have a battle that plays out in the second half of chapter 2, and three brothers, one of whom is Joab, commander of David's army, are pursuing the Saul's army led by Abner, and Abner kills one of Joab's brothers, Asahel, and then Joab and his other brother Abishai continue to pursue Abner, the commander of the army in the north. And so this war is raging. It seems like for a moment, as Joab is pursuing Abner and David's men have a slight victory for the moment, that the tide is turning in favor of David's side in this war, at least. So that brings us to the beginning of chapter 3.
All right, so let's go ahead and start reading here in 2 Samuel chapter 3 at the first verse. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel, and his second, Kileab of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel, and the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur, and the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, and the fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital, and the sixth, Ithream of Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. And I'll pause there through the first five verses. We get a bit of a summary of the whole war, as well as some family information concerning David. Talk to us about that summary that we have in verse 1. It sounds like it's going right along with what we caught at the end of 2 Samuel 2, that David's doing well, Saul is not.
Yeah. And although, you know, David seems to be gaining the advantage, David's house is growing stronger, the fact that the text describes this as a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David indicates that there's no end in sight, that this, it seems like unless something dramatic happens, that this will be just a protracted fight between these two houses. That sort of gives us a little foreshadowing into how things are resolved later on in the middle of the chapter. But for now, the war is going to drag on. These kinsmen will be fighting one against another for who knows how long. So just, it's a very bleak picture of what God intends to be his kingdom, his united kingdom. And after the first king, right, they insisted that the prophets anoint for them a king so that they could be like the nations. They've had one king. He's not been faithful his entire reign. And at his death, the nation immediately devolves into war, tribes fighting one against another. So it's just a very, very bleak picture of, well, how things go when we try to order our lives according to what all the nations are doing, instead of to how the Lord would order, how he would govern our lives. And we see just very quickly, when we try to do things our way, they quickly descend into long-term chaos.
Yeah, and chaos is not a bad word for the way we've seen things go in chapters 2 and into 3. Although, as you pointed out, the Lord is still at work, and he is bringing about the kingdom of his anointed one, David, even in the midst of all the sins that we see in these several chapters. So the summary, again, has David's house growing stronger, Saul's house growing weaker. And I think we see that come to fruition in the details that are given. We see some of the strength of David's house when you hear about his sons born to his several wives. So take us into that next section, verses 2-5, with some of David's family.
Yeah, so the fact that he has all these different wives, for instance, indicates, it sort of shows us how the strength of his kingdom is increased. Oftentimes, wives were given in exchange when an alliance would be forged with another kingdom, another tribe. So David having these wives from different tribes of the people around him indicates that at least for, how many wives are there? Six wives?
Yeah.
There are six tribes that are aligning themselves with the house of David. So that shows a particular strength. I think the footnote in the study Bible gives us insight into one of them, Maacah, who would have been from this small Aramean kingdom east of the Jordan. So that sort of would have surrounded Ishbosheth's territory a little bit, gives David an alliance to the northeast of Ishbosheth, the house of Saul. So we see that in his wives, that David's strength is increasing. And yet David's household, we're also seeing a lot of foreshadowing here about how this continual creep of sin will finally destroy the household of David. So here we have some notorious sons among David's sons. Noteworthy that among these six sons is not the son who will finally succeed David to the throne. That will be Solomon. And so Solomon's mother is also not named here. We all know the story of how David acquires Bathsheba to be one of his wives, which is at times par for the course for the household of David. But you have, you know, you'll have Amnon and Absalom will play significantly into the story of the fighting and the sin that just grows like a cancer in David's household. A few chapters later in 2 Samuel, Adonijah will be one of David's sons who will compete for the throne after David dies and Solomon is made king. But just like with this transition to David as king, when David dies and Solomon, the Lord's anointed, is made king, we see a very similar kind of thing. There's lots of would-be heirs to the throne jockeying for the kingdom. And so you have some of those characters here as well. So it confirms what verse 1 says about the strength of David's house increasing, but we also see a lot of foreshadowing here about, you know, however strong his house becomes, however mighty his kingdom becomes, he's not free from sin and from the effects that sin will wreak upon his household for generations to come.
This little section right here, I think, is a good reminder that when the Old Testament describes husbands who have multiple wives, and that's sometimes a question that gets asked of the Old Testament, that although God allows these things to happen, I don't know that it ever turns out good for the people involved. And just hearing all of these sons' names and noting that in this particular section, you know, each son has a different mother, although, as you pointed out, David's house is growing stronger, you have that sense of foreboding that when even David does not follow the design that the Lord has for marriage and family, that proves to be very disastrous to his household in particular. It's just a very good example of, yes, the Old Testament describes things that happen, but that doesn't mean that it's put forward as a good example. If anything, this is one of the first times we've seen in David's life where maybe things aren't going to go well for David in every single situation.
Yeah, I think you'll find that anytime there's a man who has multiple wives. I'm pressed to think of any one of those that works out at least temporarily successfully.
Right.
So we see the fruitlessness of pursuing things the way the world would do. But also, I wonder if that's almost inevitable when Israel asks for a king, because so much of the king's power and his ability to make alliances is in the exchange of daughters to be wives of other princes and other kings in order to establish tranquility between two different kingdoms. I wonder if that polygamy isn't baked into the recipe from the beginning of asking for a king like the nations.
Yeah, and so even David, the one who is a king after God's own heart, one who has been chosen by God, even he needs the son of David to come to redeem him, as we will see as the narrative continues through the Old Testament. So there we have the opening verse and the initial description of David's family. Now the text turns our attention back toward the house of Saul to see how that house grows weaker to David's strength. We pick up the text once more at 2 Samuel 3, verse 6. While there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David. And yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman. God do so to Abner, and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan to Beersheba. and Ishbosheth could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. That takes us through verse 11. We'll pause there again. The text now turns our attention back to the house of Saul, and the two key figures, Abner and Ishbosheth, come into conflict. Take us into the conflict described in this paragraph.
Yes, yeah, so Ishbosheth is king because Abner has anointed him to be, or made him king. I'm not sure that we get the anointing language. He is the one who is, you know, he's the kingmaker, quite literally. So he has made Ishbosheth king, and he's the strong commander of the army. And we get this verse, or part of the verse 6, Abner is making himself strong in the house of Saul. So that Ishbosheth is not, you would expect the king to be the strong one. But later, as we see at the end of this paragraph, after their conflict, Ishbosheth, the coward, the spineless one, is not even able to answer Abner another word, because he is afraid of him. So what happens, it seems like either Abner, being the strong man in the kingdom, has taken for himself what would properly belong to the king's heir, that is, the concubines of the king would be passed down like property to the king's son, to the king's heir, the next king. And so either Abner has actually taken Rizpah, the concubine, to be his own, or Ishbosheth concocts this false accusation against Abner. And so the text doesn't really give us insight into which of those is the case. Abner denies the charges, so we don't know if he is just lying, or if this is a move on Ishbosheth's part to publicly accuse Abner of something that would have turned the people against him, sort of put him in his place, and made Ishbosheth look like the stronger of the two. So either way, at this accusation, Abner stands up to Ishbosheth in anger, asks, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? Am I the pet or the puppet of the king to the south? To this day, all I have done is show steadfast love to the house of Saul, your father, and have not, though I could have, as implied there in the text, given you into the hand of David." Right? So Abner knows the power that he wields and says, "I could have up until this point, but I did not. I could have brought this whole war to an end. I could have given you into the hand of David. He would be king over a united kingdom, and I haven't." But at verse 9, we see that's what he resolves to do now. "So God do so to Abner, and more also, if I don't accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to give him." So now he comes, at least sets himself to seeing that David becomes king over the whole kingdom of Israel, the United Kingdom of Israel, as the Lord has anointed, which is just a telling little phrase as an aside, that Abner knows he was against the Lord's will in trying to carry on the household and the reign of the household of Saul. He will now transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul, see that David reigns over Israel and Judah together, all the way from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south. And this, his angry response and his now open rebellion against the king, to that, Ishbosheth has no answer.
Hmm. You get the sense that Abner really is the strong man of the house of Saul. Now that Saul has died and all the other sons besides Ishbosheth can't answer Abner another word because he feared him. We've already seen Abner's great physical strength in the previous chapter in the conflict with Asahel. And now, it just seems like Abner is not the kind of guy that you cross one way or another, physically or otherwise.
Yep.
Yeah. So Ishbosheth is left with nothing to do but cower in fear. And now the text tells us whether or not Abner means this or not. You know, is he going to make good on his word? How is he going to do concerning this oath that he has made to do what for David, what the Lord has sworn? Let's keep going now in verse 12 of the chapter. "And Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you. And he said, good, I will make a covenant with you. But one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. Then David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife Michal, for whom I paid the bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping after her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, go, return. And he returned. All right, that goes through verse 16. I will pause there again. So now Abner is going to make good on what he has said. He has meant it, and he begins to reach out to David, saying, let's make the kingdom yours. Talk to us about this back and forth and what David wants before he agrees to be with Abner.
Yeah, so they agree on this covenant. David says, one thing I require of you, that you shall not see my face. We won't conclude this negotiation. See the face of the king. He'll look favorably upon you. And the Lord speaks to us in a similar kind of way. Make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. You won't see my face. The deal won't be done until you bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. So Michal is David's wife, one of his wives. She's not one of those political wives mentioned earlier, though she has played a significant role in David's life up to this point. She's the daughter of Saul, and initially, when Saul sees that his daughter Michal loves David, it pleases him, and he gives Michal to David. David and Michal are married, but then when Saul knows that the Lord is on David's side, and now that he has Saul's daughter as his bride, that upsets Saul, will be one of the reasons that Saul will pursue David to kill him. But Michal will turn out to save her husband's life a couple times. So that's their history. I don't know. Have we been told in the text how they are, how they've been separated? Because she's become another man's wife at this point.
Right. Michal was taken. Now I'm going to have to look for this. I didn't look it up ahead of time. Michal was taken from David and given to the other man who's mentioned in 1 Samuel, I believe, while David was fleeing. And I'm not finding it right away here. I'll find it. You keep talking about what happens here with Michal, and then the actual, you know, she's given to David here. So I'll find the detail for us.
Yeah, she's given to him, and the prize is that the price that David paid for her is he brought to Saul 100 Philistine foreskins. So that has also granted Saul victory in this battle against the Philistines, that they are wounded a season.
That's right.
So
I'm going to interrupt you because I did find it. It's 1 Samuel 25, verse 44, in the aftermath of the conflict with Nabal, when David ends up taking Abigail as a wife. We had learned it was at that point Michal had been taken and given to the gentleman mentioned here, Palti, the son of Laish.
Yeah.
So it's been several chapters.
Another case to be made for monogamy.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So, but he wants Michal back at this point. And I mean, I know this also goes, I think, behind the text a little bit. So this is speculation. But, why is wanting Michal back? Why is that the condition? Of all the things he could have asked, why do you think that?
Well, I think because she's a daughter of Saul. And if they see the daughter of Saul with David, who has no blood connection to Saul, that establishes, you know, it's not unlike these political alliances made by means of exchanging a daughter to be a wife or a concubine of another king, right? So the previous king's daughter has been given to the successive king as a bride, that establishes continuity between the house of David and the house of Saul. So I think politically for David, it will win some of Saul's family over to his side if he has Michael by him again.
Sure. And that,
agree?
I think so. And particularly in connection with Abner, it shows, you know, Abner, are you being legitimate or not by bringing, you know, Michael in all the political ramifications? And then when you have Michael there with David along with Abner, again, from a political standpoint, that really solidifies David. It's not only the general who's really the guy in charge of Saul's house at this point, but Saul's daughter, who had been wrongfully taken from David in the first place, is restored. And that puts David in a very strong position politically, going along with what we talked about when it came to the various wives earlier. Although, as we see, there's this detail that's given concerning the man to whom Michael had been given. That's, you see the effects of polygamy and the negative consequences when monogamy is not upheld. I think we'll pick up that detail and more of this text on the other side of the break. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Jeff Hemmer about 2 Samuel chapter 3 this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Did you know that an investment with Lutheran Church Extension Fund exclusively supports LCMS ministries and church workers? That's right. LCEF ensures LCMS churches, schools, and organizations have access to the financial resources they need to sustain, strengthen, and start ministry work. In other words, you can feel good investing with LCEF because we share your Lutheran values and love for the church. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCEF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCEF investments are not FDIC insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCEF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCEF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Thursday, March 27th. We're studying 2 Samuel chapter 3, verses 1 to 30 with Pastor Jeff Hemmer. He serves at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. He is also the assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Pastor Hemmer, prior to the break, we were talking about David's demand that Michael, his wife, Michael, who is Saul's daughter, be given back to him. She had been given away to another man, a Palti or Paltiel. He's given both names in the scriptures. That happened back in 1 Samuel 25. Now, David wants her back. He's told Abner this. The message actually goes to Ishbosheth to go get Michael for him. He does, and then you get the reaction of her, I don't even know how long she would have been with Palti, but he's not happy about it either. Take us into the rest of the scene.
Yeah, so not only has Abner told Ishbosheth to his face, I'm fighting for the other guy now, and I'm going to give all of your kingdom into his hand, but now, in order for Abner to meet with David face to face, David asks this thing of him, and so Abner goes to King Ishbosheth and sends him to go do the dirty work of getting this other man's wife and bringing him back to her first husband. And so you see just the weakness of Ishbosheth being ordered around by Abner then. And then Paltiel sort of follows his wife. Her husband went with her, weeping all the way to Baharim, until Abner says to him, go back. And he goes back. And that's just a peculiar little detail recorded for us in the text that shows, I mean, it sort of shows how Abner is controlling this whole scene. So you have these two strong personalities, David and Abner, and which one is really driving this negotiation? It seems to go back and forth for a moment, but here we have a glimpse into just the strength of Abner's personality as well, that he just tells the husband, go back.
Yeah.
And he does.
And he does. And he does. Yeah. And you chuckle at it, I suppose, but it's a terribly sad scene just in the whole story that, first of all, that Michael was ever taken from David, which was not good. Then that she was given to another man. And now that she's being taken from that man, you see the way that sin entangles and sin hurts people. Even, and I suppose I feel bad mostly for Paul Thiel, because he of all people has really been the one that's been sinned against, and it comes back on him in pretty much all negative ways up until this, right through the end of this little section.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and even I just while you were talking, I went and looked up the verse where Michael was given to Paul T, and so David has taken Abigail as his wife, but then 25 verse 43, David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, right, and both of them became his wives. And so then Saul gives Michael to Palti, and that, you know, that's not insignificant, because then we have Abigail and Ahinoam right there in the list of David's wives at the beginning.
Right.
So, I mean, all of these things are woven together, and the way in which David is acting as a king according to the worldly ways of the kings around him is just on full display. And to your point about the futility of polygamy, it will take the son of David and his decidedly monogamous union with his bride, the church, to untangle all this Gordian knot of sin.
Yeah. And that ultimately is where all of these scriptures are pointing us forward, is to that son of David who comes and redeems us from such sin. So back to the narrative here in 2 Samuel chapter 3. So David's wife, Michal, has been returned to him. This was the condition for meeting face to face with Abner. And now that covenant comes to full fruition between David and Abner as the text progresses. We're starting again now in verse 17. And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, "For some time past you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then bring it about, for the Lord has promised David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.' Abner also spoke to Benjamin, and then Abner went to tell David at Hebron all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, 'I will arise and go, and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires.' So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace." I'm going to pause there. That takes us through verse 21. So take us into some of the back and forth here that Abner does to get Israel over to David's side.
Yeah, so here we learn that the elders of Israel have already been inclined to have David as king over them. Or is it just Abner's power of suggestion that he says to them, "You've been seeking David to be king over you, so let's bring it about"? And his rationale is, "The Lord has promised David, saying..." So again, Abner knows that David is the Lord's man to be king over a united Israel, just like we had back in verse 9, "If I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him." Now, the Lord had sworn to David that he would give to him the kingdom, that he would be king following Saul. But this promise, "By the hand of my servant, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies," I don't think is ever actually spoken of David. It is spoken of King Saul, but Abner inserts David there, knowing that if the Lord made this promise to his first anointed king, then that promise transfers over to the one whom the Lord himself intended to put onto the throne following Saul. So that promise then is what motivates the leaders of the tribes in the northern part of the kingdom to go along with Abner's plan. Abner brings the Benjaminites along, one of the larger tribes, So he gets them on board. If the Benjaminites are going to be on board with Abner's plan, if they will acknowledge David's reign, then the other tribes are going to go along with them as well. And so Abner comes with 20 men, the sign that all the tribes in the north are submitting to David's reign and David's rule over them. And they have a great feast. Abner is sort of the guest of honor at the feast. He's the one who's negotiated this deal. Abner pledges to David, "I will go, I will gather all Israel, and they will make a covenant with the king so that you may reign over all that your heart desires," is just a peculiar little phrase. Probably gives us insight both into David's desire for power, even though it is the Lord's will also, but also how a window into Abner that he sees, you know, this really is about the jockeying of human desires and human will, even though at times he acknowledges the Lord has had his hand in it and his will, but we know Abner hasn't always been going along with what he knows the Lord's will to be. So the Lord is on Abner's radar screen, but he's not, you know, he's not the one whose will is calling the shots. Only if his will and our will align is Abner willing to go along with what the Lord's will is. Just a little interesting aside there.
Well, sure. And with that aside, and then also the way that Abner speaks to the elders in verse 18 with the promise of the Lord to David and quoting something that the Lord had spoken about Saul rather than David, but inserting David's name. I mean, do you think that that's more of, again, Abner sort of trying to insert his will into things, but where perhaps he speaks more than he actually realizes? I know that the Lord didn't say that about David verbatim, but as the text continues, the Lord does do that through David. I mean, do you think that maybe there's a little bit of both going on, Abner inserting himself, but also saying a little more than he realizes?
No, I think it's exactly saying more than he realizes. I don't think it's incorrect of him to take a promise spoken to the Lord's anointed before David and to appropriate that to David as the Lord's anointed. I think that whether Abner intends that exactly or not, or whether he's just using it to manipulate these tribesmen to pledge their fealty to David or not, the fact is that God has made that promise to his anointed. And so it continues through to the Lord's anointed, who now is David. Yeah, I mean, is Abner, you know, is he a good guy or a bad guy in this? And that, I mean, that sort of sets us up for where the story will go next. But is he sincere in all of this? You can argue about that, maybe.
That's right. Yeah, it is hard to tell. And as you said, that does set us up for what else happens. The way that he behaved with Ishbosheth, you know, again, is the accusation true or not? He reacts pretty quickly. He does seem to enjoy the position that he has within Saul's house. Is he trying to gain for himself a similar position within David's house here? It's hard to say. The text doesn't reveal that. But I suppose either way, with what is said there, we do see the Lord's hand at work, even through the manipulations of sinful human beings. The Lord still is at work to set up David, his anointed one, as the king over Israel. So at this point, again, Abner has been at the feast with David. He's been the honored guest. Abner is going to leave now in peace in order to go and solidify this covenant so that David will be king over all Israel. Were that the end, perhaps we'd be able to see more of the story in terms of the questions that we have, but that's not where the story ends. There's more where we had to remember some of those details from chapter 2 and the last time Abner was important in the narrative. So we're starting to read here again in 2 Samuel 3, now at verse 22. "Just then the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, 'Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace. Then Joab went to the king and said, What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away so that he is gone? You know that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, and to know your going out and your coming in, and to know all that you are doing. When Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah. But David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him in the stomach, so that he died, for the blood of Asahel his brother. Afterward, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house. And may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge, or who is leprous, or who holds a spindle, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai his brother killed Abner, because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon. And that takes us to the end of our text for today, 2 Samuel 3, verse 30. We'll see more of the aftermath of this murder of Abner on the next text. So, okay, Pastor Hemmer, we had Abner going away in peace from David, and now here comes Joab with some other servants of David home from a raid. They find out the news. Talk to us about Joab's reaction as he expresses it to David.
Yeah, so, I mean, Joab is Abner's counterpart in, you know, he's the commander of the army under David. Abner had been the commander of the army under Ishbosheth. So Abner now is bringing the northern king, the northern tribes under David's kingship. And so you have that dynamic going on, but also Abner had killed Joab's brother as they were pursuing him. And I don't know if it's worth mentioning the fastest of the three brothers,
right.
Asahel, swift as foot as a wild gazelle. So he's the one who's chasing Abner down, and Abner has stabbed him through with the butt end of his spear, right? Struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear, hard enough that it comes out his back, the text had said. And so then, you know, Joab and Abishai, his other brother, have been pursuing Abner since then. They've got this grudge, this desire for vengeance against Abner. And now when Joab returns, who has just been there except his mortal enemy, the guy who killed his brother, now seems to be posturing for Joab's position in the kingdom as well. And Joab's reaction to the king is, why did you let him go? You had him. He was right here. So David doesn't appear to share Joab's bloodlust, but you had him here. And then Joab says, Abner is not a trustworthy guy. He came to deceive you. He just wants to know you're going out, you're coming in, to know all that you are doing. Maybe in the eyes of Joab, Abner is just deceiving David in order that David might be overthrown. And then what? All these tribes that Abner has marshaled together will support him as king? We don't know. But you have this strong clash between Joab and Abner, and this unanswered question for us is Abner genuine in bringing these tribes under David, or is he deceiving David and Joab sees the real Abner? Or is Joab blinded by his desire for revenge, that he can't see anything good that Abner does? Sort of, it's left to the reader to decide.
Yeah, it's hard to say. You kind of have to look at the rest of 2 Samuel to maybe have an idea. There are times where David seems naive in the way that he deals with people, at least from an earthly political standpoint. And so whereas Joab does seem to be, at least in certain points, a little more shrewd in that regard, such that it it makes me wonder, maybe Joab is onto something, maybe he's right. But at the same time, I don't think Joab's actions in this text or his judgment entirely are pure either. Perhaps it's just best to know that somewhere in all of this, all three of these men, David, Joab, and Abner, are sinning and have impure motives, and they all need the Son of David to redeem them from that, even if we can never say for certain what their motivations are in this text.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you have any more insight into it? Take a guess at who's right, who's wrong, or we just want to leave it with that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You're right. Often than not, Joab seems to prove more righteous than David. I mean, you think a few chapters later, for instance, in the spring when kings go off to war,
right,
and David stays back on his couch, I don't know, playing his PS5, and Joab, the commander of the king's army, is out fighting, doing the king's business.
Yeah,
he'll do David's bidding, even to the point of exposing his own men to an unnecessary defeat. Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, nobody has clean hands in any of this, but it does seem maybe from a 30,000 foot view, like Joab is a little bit, has a little more integrity, sees things a little bit more the way that they are. Mm.
Yeah. But even then, as you pointed out, his desire for revenge, I think, colors good chunk of his actions here. And we've kind of seen that already at the end of chapter 2, where Joab and Abishai were both pursuing Abner. And it was really only when Abner, you know, got in a better position of support and Abner called him off that Joab stopped. But it was almost even then like he was waiting for a better opportunity to go ahead with the revenge that he desires. And I do wonder also, we probably should mention, there is a family connection here with Joab. Joab and his brothers are nephews to David. And so I also wonder if the way Joab responds to David, it also is appealing to him as the uncle. Like, look, Uncle David, why aren't you doing anything about nephew Asahel, our brother? How could you just let him go? I think there's so many dynamics there from the human perspective that, as you said, it's hard to see anybody with completely clean hands in this text.
Yeah, and if we want to see Joab in a negative light, maybe he's just so set on killing Abner that he could win David over to his cause if he convinces David that Abner's deceiving him from the beginning.
Mm, yeah.
Then David will overlook, it won't just be revenge, it'll be avenging the king as well, defending the king.
All right. So regardless of the motivations that Joab may have, whether he's right or wrong about Abner, he has resolved to do something about Abner, which is where our text ends. So take us into the plotting, and the execution of the plot that Joab has against Abner, and then at least the fallout from that in this text. Again, more will come as the chapter continues in the next text we look at tomorrow.
Yeah. So Joab goes away from David. He sends messengers after Abner, and to bring him back, says David doesn't know about it. Abner comes back. Joab takes him aside privately and there struck him in the stomach. Noteworthy that that's the same way in which Abner struck Asahel, so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. So Joab gets what he wants from the end of chapter 2. He avenges his brother's death, but David hears about it and makes this condemnation against the house, not just Joab's house, but all of Joab's father's house, which will include Abishai, his brother, and all of Asahel, the brother who died, all of his family as well. So what's their father's name?
I don't remember their father's name. Their mother is Zeruiah.
Zeruiah.
Or is that, isn't that David's sister, Zeruiah?
Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, so I guess we don't know. We don't have their father's name. Anyway, the whole household is judged. And David says, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless of the blood of Abner. So guiltless into eternity of this thing, and Joab's house is forever guilty. so that his house is never without. And then David lays out all these effects of sin that are punishment on the house of Joab for killing Abner. So his house will always have one with a discharge, one who is leprous, one who has to use a crutch to walk, one who dies by the sword, or one who is hungry forever because of this thing, which is, yeah, so David's not persuaded by Joab's trying to indict the motives of Abner. He doesn't see Joab's killing Abner as a righteous thing at all. And maybe there's a fear that with Abner dead, this whole treaty that's going to unify the kingdom under David is going to fall apart.
Yeah.
David has to look strong. He has to look like he's able to still manage the kingdom. So he lays this curse upon the household of Joab and all his father's house.
Yeah, I do think that there's probably something in David's mind about whether or not this covenant with Abner will survive what's just happened. I think that's probably going through his mind, particularly given the way that the text progresses into the rest of chapter 3 and David's further response, which we will, again, pick up more tomorrow. For right now, Pastor Hammer, we've got about 2 minutes left. You know, reflecting upon this chapter, we've already kind of speculated a little bit. It just seems everybody has their hands dirty in some way. How do we approach a text like this as Christians, and how does it finally point us to Christ?
Yeah, well, when Jesus is called the Son of David, David's son and David's Lord, that does not, you know, that's not based just on the nobility of David, as if it's a noble thing for Jesus to be a descendant of David, because this is the mess that he comes from. And then, of course, he's not a descendant of any of these sons of David that we had at the beginning. He is the descendant of Solomon, who is David's son, second child, by the wife of Uriah, who's not even named. So the Son of David, the Word of God, who becomes human flesh, descends down into the messiest of all humanity. And his genealogy tells exactly of that, right? I mean, it's the kind of stuff that you would read on the cover of a tabloid in a supermarket checkout line. Like, the incarnate Son of God has all these sordid people in his family tree. And that is to the point. He comes to take the sin of all mankind upon himself. So no king, no earthly king, will do what the King of Kings can do. No human scheming, no conniving, no truces or treatises or political alliances that we create on our own can work the Lord's redemption for his people. It will take someone who is altogether unlike us in his sinlessness, but altogether one of us in his flesh, to be able to restore creation, to be the one to bear David's sin, Joab's sin, Abner's sin, our sin upon himself on the cross, and set aright the one true united kingdom, which is now his church.
Pastor Jeff Hemmer serves at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. He's also the assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He's been helping us today to study 2 Samuel chapter 3, verses 1 to 30. Pastor Hemmer, thanks for being our guest today.
It's been a pleasure, Pastor Apple, as always.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about this section of 2 Samuel 3, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again tomorrow as we keep reading in 2 Samuel 3 and into chapter 4, how the Lord does secure the kingdom for David. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again tomorrow.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to KFUO.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to KFUO.org/store.